Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Exotics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, lecturer at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies based at the University of Edinburgh, Emma Keeble. Thank you, Emma. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be speaking today, and thank you for joining this webinar. Today's webinar is on common problems in African pygmy hedgehogs, the pet species rather than the wild species that we might also see in practice. So I'm going to just run through some of the things that I see quite regularly in these pets and a little bit of background information about them in general. As usual with exotics, it's always important to know exactly how they should be kept, and that has a relevance and bearing on all the diseases and problems that we tend to see. So we will progress with the seminar. Let me just. So one of the things that I thought was interesting to think about is just how many exotic pets are on the increase and on the rise, really often sort of influenced by the media. I've put a few pictures of some very well-known exotic species that we do tend to see in practice. Now, the African pygmy hedgehog has actually been around as a pet for quite a while now. And like all these things, you sort of wonder if it's going to be a passing phase. But actually, I feel that we're seeing more and more of these being kept as pets, and that this isn't just a sort of passing fad. It seems to be something that owners are genuinely interested in keeping and seem to keep very well, actually. The majority of our owners are very well informed about husbandry and diet. But obviously, there will be exceptions to that, and there will be the person who's, you know, perhaps suddenly purchased one at the weekend on a sort of whim from Gumtree. So this does still happen. But we obviously do want to think about, from a veterinary point of view, what are the implications for disease transfer, and what are the sort of problems you might see associated with husbandry and diet if these are not being kept as they should do. One thing I find a little bit sort of tricky with these guys is the handling. We do teach our students to always wear gloves, I guess because of the risk of zoonoses, which I'll come on to at the very end of the lecture. But in particular, ringworm could potentially be spread to you from these animals if they were infected. So wearing gloves is a good practice. And I usually explain this to owners because often these animals are very much part of the family and their pets, and putting on a pair of sort of latex gloves isn't always looked on favorably. But if we explain that this is because we don't want to get any diseases ourselves, but also transfer to other animals, you know, if we've got other pets in or seeing other hedgehogs in the day. One thing that can really help is just to wrap them in a little blanket, and that will avoid you getting too sharply pricked by the spines. A lot of these really do resent being handled and start to huff, and that's where I find it challenging, because they actually push up against you and you can very quickly get your hand inoculated by the spine. So just using a little sort of fleece blanket to sort of cuddle them and roll them up. And then once you've actually placed them on your examination table, a gentle sort of rocking side to side can help get the feet out so that they place them on the table. And you might then be able to see a little bit more of the animal itself. I also find sort of gentle stroking of the spines, starting from the head end and working your way towards the back end, can be really beneficial, and sometimes then the head will come out. There will be the odd individual you just cannot get a good look at, but it depends how well handled they are and how used to people. If they're very well handled, you may be able to grasp the hind legs as they come out and just gently tip the animal forwards, and I've got a picture of this to show you in a minute. Many of them won't allow you to do that and will just curl back up. And obviously you do have to be careful if there's a history or a suspicion of any problem with the spine or the back legs, or in an elderly animal that might have arthritis, just be very careful with that technique. Another thing that I find really useful in some animals, you can gently use a padded wooden spatula to have a look in the mouth. And particularly, a lot of these animals are presenting with inappetence or dental disease or perhaps oral tumours, salivation, and you want to have a really good look in the mouth without perhaps an anaesthetic. Then using a little wooden spatula with a bit of padded vet wrap around it can be really helpful. And again, I've got a photo of that to show you in just a second. So this is a picture just showing gentle sort of grasping of both hind legs and holding them above the animal to elevate it so that it places its forelimbs down on the table. As I said before, if you had any suspicion that there was spinal disease or arthritis, you really wouldn't want to be doing this. Those sorts of things might show if the animal's having difficulty curling, and particularly if there's a limb still sticking out when the animal has curled up. I very much would not do this technique because there's a risk that that actually could be a fractured limb. But if you're happy to go ahead, then quite a few animals will tolerate this very well, actually. And you can therefore get a good look on the underside of the animal. If you're doing the holding, you might then get someone else to have a look at the head end while it's out and examine the eyes and the ears and the nose and just check that everything looks okay. It's difficult to pull the forelimbs up because the tendency is to curl from the nose in. So using the hind limbs can be quite a useful way, to have a good look at the animal. But don't be worried if you really can't get a good look and the animal's curling up. You may still have to use anesthesia, maybe a gas anesthetic, to have a very quick look and a full examination. When it comes to sexing, it's actually very, very simple in hedgehogs. This is actually a picture I've got here showing a male and female European hedgehog, but it's very, very similar for the African pygmy hedgehog. You can see that the males are much greater anogenital distance, so I'll just show you with the pointer here. This is a male on the right. You've got the prepuce here. And then the anus back here. So really quite a large anogenital distance. And you can also see testicles here, which are perhaps more prominent in the breeding season. And in the female, you've got a much shorter anogenital distance. This is actually the tail here, then the anus, and then we've got the vulva there. So quite a simple, straightforward way of telling the difference between males and females. One thing to note that's of interest is in the males, they do have these quite large accessory sex glands. So if you were to do a post-mortem or perhaps if you were ultrasound scanning the abdomen, you might want to bear those in mind because you might get confused as to what these tubular structures are in the abdomen. Also interesting, just have a little think about how these animals are in the wild and what they're doing, because this obviously has relevance to how we're keeping them in captivity. They are native to Central and Eastern Africa, so they will be found in the wild, and they're quite amazingly adaptive. They can live up to sort of 2,000 meters high in the mountains, but they're more commonly found in sort of lowland areas, either sort of grassy plains in the savanna or actually also in woodlands too. And so, thinking about their environment and what's normal for them, they will go into a torpid state, particularly if there's very extremes of temperature. So actually they can aestivate, which is in the summertime when they get quite warm, they can sleep, but they can also sleep if they get too cold. And this is more of relevance, I think, to captive bred animals that require supplementary heating. I've got some average weights there as well, just to show you this sort of weight discrepancy, which is a little bit different between male and female animals. But I think what's perhaps more important is if you're seeing an animal on a regular basis, is recording changes in weight. And this is obviously really important if an animal's not eating and is losing weight. They are insectivorous as well. So in the wild, they'd be eating things like snails, spiders, insects, invertebrates, and they may take a small amount of plant material as well. They are solitary, so they don't tend to need to be housed with other hedgehogs, and they are nocturnal as well. So you could argue they're not ideal pets to keep out during the night time. You don't tend to see them so much. They sleep during the day. One thing to also note is that they will very commonly perform anointing behavior, which is normal. So if you're seeing a hedgehog suddenly turning around and licking its spines and frothing almost at the mouth, this is not, rabies or anything like that. It's normal anointing behavior. And it is something I've seen quite commonly. You can see the picture at the bottom there. In animals that are being induced with gaseous anesthesia. So perhaps the smell of the gas will induce this behavior. And I think I've mentioned to you as well that they will hiss and fizz and make all these sort of huffy noises and roll up, which can make examining them quite difficult. Having said that, you can see the picture at the top, they're quite inquisitive. So if you leave the animal for a period of time and just let them come out in their own time, you might then get a good view and be able to see it moving around and get an idea as to how well it's walking. In captivity, obviously the bigger the enclosure, the better really, and that's what I'd try to encourage our owners to do. Even the tank in the picture there is really a little bit small. And you think in the wild they'll be, you know, travelling great distances every night, really as much exercise as possible, really important. So you can see that there is actually an exercise wheel in that enclosure. So we've got that just up. Probably don't need to point to you, but you can just see it there, which is really useful. And we've also got, you can also put them in balls like you can hamsters. Just watch that they're, you know, obviously kept an eye on, so that they're not likely to wander too far or get into any difficulties. You do need some bedding for foraging, hide area, ideally sort of hot and cold ends, and supplementary heating I think is the most important thing. Often owners don't provide these in my experience, and just having a heat mat perhaps for a third of the length of the tank on the back of it with a thermostat is really, really important. And also having a thermometer to measure the tank temperature range as well, which I've given you there. A thermostat is absolutely essential because there's quite a high risk if you don't add a thermostat to a heat mat of overheating and fire. So I'd always recommend, and actually if you start looking at the heat mat sort of manufacturers' recommendations, they all say have a thermostat attached to this to prevent that. So you set a maximum temperature basically, and you have a little probe that goes through into the tank and therefore, again, attached to the side so the animal can't get too close to it. You know what the maximum temperature is. These animals are pretty good at using a litter tray, so perhaps a wood-based pellet. And it is also a really good idea to give them quite some water that they can get into if need be. When it's actually quite warm outside, you can also provide, let them out into a run if possible. They are pretty good at escaping, so do be careful of that. What should we feed them in captivity? Well, you can see from this picture here, they are very prone to obesity. And when you start looking online for images, you can see that a lot of the pet animals that people post pictures of their beloved pets, they're really morbidly obese. So we need to be very much educating our owners about this possibility. And I think, you know, a good, well-balanced diet, I've sort of listed some of the items there in that slide, is really essential. And perhaps measuring it out fairly carefully so we know exactly what's being fed, because the temptation is always to give a little bit more. So you could either feed, you know, a dry cat food, which is quite good for dental health and hygiene, or an insectivorous diet that you can get commercially available. And on top of that, we'd probably be wanting to add some insects and maybe also some other sort of bits and pieces as treats, you know, just a few times a week. And usually you'd want to feed them at night because obviously they're nocturnal, and then any food that's left I would remove in the morning because it's going to be quite warm in that tank and you don't want it going off. Got some fairly cute photos of baby hoglets. Breeding is something, again, that we're finding more and more clients are getting involved with and wanting to breed their African pygmy hedgehogs. And they are relatively easy to breed. They are very quickly sexually mature at only 2 months of age. And one of the things that we do recommend is breeding them fairly early on because of the situation similar to guinea pigs, really, that you can get fusion of the pubic symphysis. They have a relatively short gestation period, but the young are born really altricious without sort of the eyes open and the spines are not formed yet and they're sort of pink and hairless, really. The spines come through after a few days, and obviously this is quite a good adaptation for the female to aid the birthing process. One thing to be aware of is that cannibalism is quite common. Obviously, you do need to remove the male from the enclosure, but also the female, if disturbed, could potentially eat the young. So, giving the animal as much quiet as possible and hide areas and sort of nesting areas is really key. You can see from the pictures they can have quite a few in one sitting. So, quite a lot for that animal to cope with. But absolutely gorgeous baby hoglets, very cute. Moving on to clinical procedures, it can be frustrating at times to get blood samples from these guys, and I'll just talk you through. I've got some pictures to talk you through the different sites. Usually, pretty much, this has to be done under anaesthesia, usually gaseous anaesthesia. Otherwise, though, injections are relatively straightforward. The subcutaneous injections can be given in the flank or just literally sort of at the base of the neck. But the problem that you get is as you go to inject, they tend to huff and they can jump backwards. And this can either cause you to jump, or obviously, if you've got your needle in place, it could end up with you sticking it too deep. So just be very careful and be aware of that particular individual, whether it is likely to huff. If it is, usually when you grasp the spines to give a subcutaneous injection, it will huff at that point and that will give you forewarning. The IM injection is very similar to in wild hedgehogs when the animal's curled up. The sort of leading edge of the ball is called the orbicularis muscle. It's basically, if you imagine, the hedgehog's disappeared into the ball and you've got that round opening on the underside, that round opening is the muscle and you can inject into that area IM fairly straightforwardly. This is a picture with the hedgehog on its back. It's literally just showing you the forelimb, and I hope you can just about make out. There we go, there's a cephalic vein running along the edge of the forelimb, and that's a site that we can use for taking bloods but also for IV catheter placement. And then this is a picture with an anaesthetized hedgehog showing the hind limb extended. And again, hopefully you can see quite nicely there the saphenous vein, which runs along the caudal aspect. So we've got it just about there running along of the hind limb. The problem with this is it can look really, really obvious, but can actually be easily blown and quite mobile, so it can be very difficult to get from both those sites. So we usually would clip an Emla, forelimbs and hind limbs once the animal's anaesthetized. The Emla's going to help them not feel too sore afterwards, so I always feel it's a little bit nicer to do that. If you're really struggling, then you could use the jugular vein. But in obese animals, this is very difficult. You often can't actually visualize the jugular. And again, it would need to be under anesthesia. What this picture is depicting is actually an animal being euthanized. And we've already actually injected the pentobarbital. But it's showing you the cranial vena caval approach. With the animal lying on its back, the neck is extended. You can actually palpate, there's a wee notch that runs between the manubrium and the forelimb, and that's where you're going in with your needle. You're aiming the needle towards the contralateral hind limb, so you can see the direction of that arrow that I'm showing you there towards the hind limb, and then about a 45 degree angle to place your 45 degree angle of your needle and syringe to place your injection. And you can see there I'm only about half the depth of the needle in. And this is a site that you can use for blood draw as well. I use it a lot for euthanasia too. So perhaps in the first instance, if you haven't used this site before, practice when you're putting an animal to sleep. And that will then give you perhaps more expertise when it comes to an animal that you're trying to do a blood draw. So that's a kind of bit of a background. Obviously, you're thinking what's going on because this is supposed to be common problems seen in practice. So we'll move on to those sorts of problems and go through them, and I'll try and emphasize the ones that I see more commonly than others. We do definitely see ocular disease, and we actually had a little one in last week that had a anterior chamber hyperpion. Obviously, we're looking at what else is going on with that animal, but it just highlights that, yes, ocular disease is relatively common. The main thing I tend to see is corneal ulceration, and often that's foreign bodies. So treatment and diagnosis is exactly as for other animals, the main problem being whether owners will be able to actually administer ocular drops. Another thing to note is, and you can see the picture at the bottom here, ocular proptosis is relatively common because they've got quite a shallow orbit, quite a large retrovertebral fat pad. So if you've got a prolapsed eye, you might find that you need to go ahead and enucleate it. Another thing we do see is they get older, cataracts, and these are age-related usually. But it's not the end of the world. You know, as long as you keep the enclosure the same and don't move things around, they seem to tolerate this very well. Other problems we see, ear disease. It's quite common for owners to bring an animal in because they're worried that the ears are perhaps a little bit dry and scaly. So pineal dermatitis, and this can be for a variety of different reasons. You can see the list on that slide there. Most commonly, I would say fungal and ectoparasites, perhaps the most common things that you would be thinking of in the first instance. And again, like with other animals, you want to be taking samples to find out exactly what's causing this problem. Treatments very similar to other species. Again, it's probably more whether we can actually topically apply them or not, and depending on the animal and donor compliance as well. Dental disease in pet hedgehogs is very common. Certainly we see a lot of gingivitis and calculus build-up, particularly on the sort of softer diets. But another thing we tend to see in sort of 3 years plus hedgehogs is a lot of squamous cell carcinoma, oral neoplasms, very, very common. The sort of things you might see, reduced appetite, weight loss, salivation, pouring at the mouth, and we need to be treating and diagnosing these as for other species. I've got a wee picture here. This is a little hedgehog. It's relatively thin, but it basically had no teeth whatsoever. You can almost tell that from the picture, actually, the way it's got its mouth quite open. It literally had gums, and all its teeth had fallen out through time, and probably through infection, yet the owner hadn't noticed. So this animal was only on soft food, and they do really, really like the sort of convalescent diets such as Hill's AD, but it could be any type of convalescent diet if you're trying to build up one of these little hedgehogs for a short period of time. Moving on, we do see quite a few cases of bronchopneumonia, and this can be quite challenging, particularly when you've got a huffy animal. Is this normal respiratory pattern? Is it the animal getting stressed with the environment being there? So often in these cases, what I'll do is get owners to video them at home so we can get more natural respiratory pattern and rate, and get them to do that and bring in that video so we can see what's going on in the home environment. Bacterial causes are common, more rare to get problems with parasitic disease, which we classically think of in the wild European hedgehogs, unless the animal has been housed outside, because there's an intermediate host, usually worm, earthworm or slugs. So if it's an indoor house animal, it's very, very unlikely. I think the other main differential would be, you know, cardiac disease or PAPS, pulmonary neoplasia. Obviously, with any respiratory problem, we need to be looking at the environment and general hygiene and also ventilation for that animal, because obviously these will have important parts to play in the development of the disease. Another thing that we can get, if an owner's been syringe feeding an inappetent animal, then obviously you can get aspirated food material and have an aspiration pneumonia. I didn't have any lovely radiographs, actually. It's difficult when you're radiographing these guys. you have got to be careful because the spines are quite superimposed. So I generally, once they're anaesthetized for radiography, I tend to try and gently pull the spines upwards so that they're away from the thoracic area and you've got a bit of a clearer picture. But you might see the classic sort of clinical signs associated with upper respiratory disease, but also you should be able to auscultate and listen to see if you've got any respiratory noise as well associated with the lower airways. Quite often these animals have lost weight and are lethargic as well, and that might be the only clinical sign that the owner's noticed. With other species, we can do similar diagnostic tests as other species. You know, we would want to do radiography in bloods. We can do bronchoalveolar lavage and then look at cytology and culture of samples. And I put CT in brackets. It's something we're using quite a lot, actually. It's fantastic for the airways in particular. And depending on the animal, we have performed conscious CT as long as we can gently sort of roll up towels around the animal and keep it relatively restrained long enough for the CT images to be taken. Our treatments for bronchopneumonia, again, you know, really depending on what our cultures are, but we would want to be thinking about systemic antibiosis, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. We can use bronchodilators and bronchiolytics, and nebulization is always really helpful. On top of that, we might be wanting to consider fluids and supplementary supportive care with nutritional support, and obviously thinking about the husbandry as well. I would recommend, if you're dealing with a lot of exotics, there's a new fifth edition of the Exotic Animal Formulary that's just come out by James Carpenter, and in there is a whole chapter on dose rates for African pygmy hedgehog, so really helpful in terms of choosing which antibiotic and so forth. So cardiomyopathy is something I've just touched on in the earlier slide. It's actually relatively common, and something you definitely should be thinking about if you've got a dyspneic hedgehog. Is it primary lung disease, or is it actually heart disease that we're looking at? So from 3 years onwards, it can be pretty prevalent in my experience, but you can see it as early as a year old. Classically, you get weight loss and anorexia, but the animal might be dyspneic if it's very advanced. And when you take your radiographs under gaseous anesthesia, you may see that the heart's enlarged. You may see pleural effusion as well, and pulmonary edema. So having a look, it's very similar diagnosis really to other species, but an ultrasound scan is probably the way forwards. Echocardiogram, again, this will have to be anaesthetized to get everything ready to do that. You could be concerned about doing that in an animal that's debilitated and has secondary issues associated with heart disease, but I think it's best to get a diagnosis and then you can instigate a treatment plan. We don't really know what causes it in African pygmy hedgehogs. There's been sort of quite a few things postulated, but we do diagnose it similarly to other species. I have some suggested drugs there. Now, I know there are more sort of more recent sort of newer cardiac drugs that are available, but unfortunately there aren't sort of obvious dose rates for those. I think we're a little bit behind in terms of our cardiac medicine and for hedgehogs, but I do have doses for furosemide, 2 to 4 mg/kg per os or subcut or IM every 8 hours has been suggested. Enalapril is 0.5 mg per kg per os once a day. And there is also a dose rate actually in the formulary that I mentioned for pimobendan, which is 0.3 mg per kg per os every 12 hours for congestive heart failure. Obviously, long term, the prognosis is going to be poor and these cases are likely to progress. Moving on to gastrointestinal and hepatic disease, enteritis is actually very common in these guys. We do see this quite a lot, owners coming in saying that they've had diarrhea, and it's quite a challenge often to find out the cause of that. But thinking about obviously diet, but also infectious causes such as bacterial enteritis or parasitic enteritis, you know, doing your fecal screening for parasites and cultures as well is going to be helpful. But we do need to think about salmonella in particular. This is potentially zoonotic, and also carrier status can occur as well as resistance. So if we're thinking about salmonella or concerned about that, we do need to be educating the client as well. Often these animals do lose weight, they become lethargic, they get dehydrated, and if they're really debilitated and not picked up at an early stage, it can lead to the demise of the animal. And they do get very, very sore, you know, around the anal area as well. Thinking about other things that could cause gastrointestinal problems, they can actually eat things, and owners often let them roam around the house, and carpet in particular is something that can be ingested and cause pyloric foreign bodies. They don't vomit, so you won't see regurgitating or vomiting in these animals, so the animal will become collapsed, lethargic, and abdominal pain. Something that's important to note, that quite often when they're ill, they do have a degree of ileus, and you get gaseous pockets really within the GI tract. So it can be a general sign of ill health as opposed to an actual impaction or obstruction. Obviously, if there is an obstruction, it would look much more severe radiographically. Other things that perhaps you see, maybe less commonly, although we again had a case just a month ago in an African pygmy hedgehog of really severe gastritis. We didn't get to the bottom of what was causing it, but this was confirmed on endoscopy and biopsy. There was pretty severe gastric ulceration, and it responded well to antacids and covering antibiotics. Whether this could be stress related, we don't know, but obviously, like any of the sort of inflammatory conditions of the GI tract, supportive care is really, really important. Other things, I'd sort of touched on causes of diarrhea in terms of bacterial and parasitic, but we also need to be thinking about neoplastic infiltrates such as lymphosarcoma, which unfortunately would be diagnosed usually on either post-mortem, or I guess potentially if you were to do an exploratory laparotomy and take biopsies. But other things could come into play, changes in diet, access to toxins, malnutrition. Often animals do get very loose droppings following on from not really eating well. Other things that are perhaps less common, one thing to point out in very obese animals is that hepatic lipidosis can occur if an animal stopped eating. And so very important to bear this in mind in an anorexic animal presenting to you. But obviously we can get neoplastic conditions, either primary or secondary, affecting the liver as well. I think probably things like that might be more likely to be picked up on a CT. We can actually sort of measure the density of the liver and confirm hepatic lipidosis on CT. So don't be afraid to be using these sort of more advanced imaging modalities in your smaller sort of more exotic patients. Quite a few of ours are actually insured, and owners are very keen because they're very attached to their pet to do as much as possible in terms of investigation. Moving on to urinary tract disease, I do find this is again quite common, particularly in females. They do seem to be prone to cystitis and urolithiasis. One thing to think about as well is perhaps whether this could be genital disease. Female hedgehogs are also prone to infections of the uterus and potentially neoplastic conditions of the uterus. So it's worth bearing in mind, if you've got blood in the urine, could this be from reproductive tract instead? But certainly cystitis, urolithiasis, renal disease as well, very common in quite young animals, 2 years onwards. And again, might be sort of fairly nondescript clinical signs such as weight loss or reduced appetite, which, when you're looking back through these slides, you'll see most of the things that these animals present with. So it's working out what systems affected and doing your diagnostics to determine that. Radiography under GA probably essential. If you've got a urolith, you're likely to see that. You might see changes in size of the kidneys as well. And at the same time, we can potentially get a sample of urine for urinalysis and culture. I mean, this could be free catch. If it's an animal that's been litter trained and you've got a clean litter tray, you could put them into a little pea pod and try and get a sample that way. But you might also be able to anaesthetize your animal, ultrasound scan the bladder, and under ultrasound guided, take a fine needle aspirate of the bladder and a sample that way. Treatments really basically are the same as for other mammals. So, you know, think about whether you've got a bacterial condition or not, and treat appropriately. I did actually touch on reproductive disease on the previous slide, but if we've got vulval hemorrhage, we need to be thinking, as I said, about neoplastic conditions or infections that could be going on, or is this animal potentially pregnant and something else is going on with that. I've got the picture at the top just to show you anemia, again looking at color of mucous membranes, but confirming that on your blood sample is really key. If this animal has been producing a lot of hemorrhage for a period of time, it probably is anemic. You want to be thinking about that before you go ahead with any surgery. We have had, you know, confirmed cases of uterine neoplasia, usually following ultrasound scan of the reproductive tract and showing that it's enlarged and abnormal, and then have gone ahead and neutered that animal. So fairly straightforward to perform ovarian hysterectomy in these guys. They're fairly sort of slack in terms of the ovarian ligaments, and we just go for a central midline incision. One thing also to note, the bottom picture showing a wee male hedgehog, and you can see sort of midline the prepuce there. This is obviously an area where you could get entrapment of material, so it's just there. And this could lead to prolapse of the penis and problems with urination. So if that's presenting in a male, think urolithiasis or cystitis, but also have a good check of that area under anesthesia. This little guy was amazing, actually. It let us have a really good look, and it's quite unusual to be that sort of relaxed, really, with examination. Moving on to musculoskeletal problems, my next two sort of conditions to think about are pretty common problems that we see. So we'll talk a little bit about the musculoskeletal problems, but the second problem that we see a lot of is neoplastic conditions as well. Obviously, with any animal, we can get, as they get older, spondylosis, arthritis, disc disease, fractures through trauma, and then lameness disorders. I would say, you know, African pygmy hedgehog 3+ is quite a reasonable age, and we see 4 to 5-year-olds, but it's less common. As they get older, they do tend to get issues, particularly with neoplasia. When we talk about neurological diseases, there can be lots of different causes of this, and quite often what they present with is ataxia, so this sort of wobbly hedgehog. This can be a multiple, many different things can cause this, so in particular things like a low body temperature, but we'll talk about also wobbly hedgehog syndrome. There are other things, disc disease, traumas, infections, toxins, you know, general sort of systemic disease and weakness. So when you see a wobbly hedgehog, don't just think this is, you know, demyelinating paralysis. It could be other things as well. Other potential clinical signs that you might see, neurological clinical signs, would be circling. This is often due to middle ear disease, otitis media or interna, but there can also be nutritional causes. And I mentioned intervertebral disc disease. This is quite a progressive condition that can lead to problems, particularly with the hind legs if it's lower down the spine. So moving on to demyelinating paralysis, I've got a video to show you in a minute with a wobbly hedgehog. This is actually of unknown cause, although we suspect that this may be a congenital issue. It is a progressive neurodegenerative disease, and it's been very much documented in America, occurring from about 2 years onwards, where they've got a sort of 10% incidence. What can happen initially is you get this sort of mild ataxia, sort of stumbling and tripping. And we had one in just last week. I wanted to show you this video here. You can see there that it's having difficulty placing the forelimbs. There's a slight tremor as well as it's moving. And this animal had quite a wide hind limb stance as well. We're just watching it so it doesn't fall off the table, obviously, there. This animal went on to have CT. If we've not got any obvious lesions on CT, then we are more suspicious, you know, of the demyelinating paralysis being a problem. Quite often diagnosis is actually at post-mortem, but we'll come on to that. What then happens is these clinical signs progressively worsen over the next few months, and they can become so severe that the animal's falling over and seizuring at end stage. It tends to be more the hind limbs and then progresses to the forelimbs. And there are some sort of statistics there that I got from one of the textbooks just to show you how quickly this can actually progress. I've also got another picture. This is just showing you a wee animal, again, the same animal from last week that was walking around the floor in our ward, just to show you that sort of ataxia, really finding it very, very difficult moving around. And this was the first time it presented to us, so this has obviously progressed over a period of time. And because they're nocturnal, often owners aren't picking up at an early stage, you know, that there's a problem, or they might just think they're a bit weak and wobbly and, you know, for other reasons and think they're going to get better. So this was quite advanced, and it's really quite reluctant to move. Quite often when you're putting them down on the floor, they'll go as fast as they can and scurry. But obviously there's none of that going on with that particular case. So hopefully that's given you a little idea as to how they present clinically. So as I said, unfortunately, the main diagnosis is really only on post-mortem. And if we look at histology, we can see that we've got vacuoles within the white matter. It's a demyelination, particularly the cerebrum, cerebellum, brainstem, spinal cord. Second to that, we can get muscle atrophy. And I put there etiology is unknown, but it's highly suspected that this could be a congenital sort of genetic problem, and that there is this sort of relatively high incidence, sort of 1 in 10 animals affected in America. So that would explain why we've got this familial tendency, though we don't know for sure. Treatment really is only supportive. There aren't any direct medications that we can give, but we do also need to rule out other differentials which are put there, the disc disease we'd mentioned, but there could also be neoplasms causing this, and also potential, you know, hepatic lesions. So worth bearing in mind if you get a wobbly hedgehog coming in and as I say, sort of rule out everything else with your diagnostics, and then you're likely to get a sort of presumptive diagnosis. And I would get these animals back in to check them very regularly, just to check that we're not at a point where welfare is really compromised. Moving on to skin disease, I'd mentioned that neoplasia is obviously very important, but skin disease actually too. I would say that the three things we primarily see these hedgehogs coming in with are neoplasia, skin disease, and the wobbliness, neurological conditions, neuromuscular neurological conditions. With the skin disease in particular, two things, ectoparasites and fungal disease. And of the ectoparasites, Caparinia tripalis is something that we do diagnose fairly frequently. And it actually goes hand in hand with the ringworm as well. So, you know, one doesn't exclude the other. You often get both at the same time. What I think probably happens is that these animals have low levels of infection from source. And then when they're debilitated, it can become a real problem. And what you get is this progressive loss of quills and hyperkeratosis as well. Sometimes they're very pruritic too. What we need to do is either skin scrapings and perhaps sellotape tests as well, and then treatment with ivermectin is relatively straightforward. But I mentioned you also concurrently can get fungal infections, and these are really quite common. They're often not pruritic, but they do lead to crusting, particularly around the face and ears. And what we can do is proper culture, but we can also do quick sort of test, you know, dermatophyte test media can be used as well. And you can see this sort of orange coloration of the plate there after 7 to 10 days. You do need to read them at the right time, otherwise they will turn orangey red anyhow. Things that we can use, obviously topical or systemic antifungals, it really depends on the animal as to how easy it is to get oral preparations into them. Sometimes these can be put into a little tiny bit of wet food and the animal can be left to eat that first and then the rest of the meal is given. But if we do diagnose this, we need to be treating the environment but also any in contact animals as well, and obviously warning our owners that this is zoonotic and they need to wear gloves and have appropriate protective clothing. So moving on to neoplastic conditions, skin neoplasia is actually very common. We see this in older to middle-aged animals and you know, any time from sort of 3 years onwards. Things like squamous cell carcinomas and lymphosarcomas are particularly common. This picture is showing a swelling at the base of the ear of this animal, which was a fibrosarcoma. Any organ can be affected by neoplasia, and it might not just be obvious externally. So we may see a progression in weight loss and reduced appetite and lethargy. So these very nondescript sort of clinical signs that I've been talking about all the way through that hedgehogs often do present with. And it's a question of, you know, working that animal up and getting your diagnostics so you can determine what the cause is. More and more we are using CT imaging to help us evaluate this. I would certainly consider either radiography or CT and full blood work to see what we throw up. If we've got an obvious mass, we can take biopsies or fine needle aspirates for histology. We might want to consider abdominal ultrasound if we have isolated an area we're concerned about on our radiography or CT. There are treatments that we can instigate, and they, depending on the tumor type, maybe a variety of different treatments can be used. Obviously supportive care generally for the animal if it's very debilitated. We might be considering surgical resection plus minus chemotherapy, and we have also animals that have undergone radiation therapy as well. So it's worth having the talk with owners and seeing what their level of commitment is and what is also welfare-wise acceptable to put that animal through, because most of these treatments will obviously have to be given under anaesthetic. So we need to weigh up that as well. Quite often, unfortunately, they do present in quite advanced stages, so that makes it more difficult in terms of getting in there early with a treatment regime. So just a final few slides, just thinking about nutritional disease. And I mentioned right at the start how important husbandry and nutrition are for these pets and for all exotics, really. It's very, very common to get overweight animals to the point where they really cannot actually fully roll up. And if you see an animal like that, then you need to be having quite a chat with the owner about why this has happened and what the diet is and how we can increase exercise and also reduce the amount that the animal is eating. We want to be aware of sort of things like hepatic lipidosis and high cholesterol, and try and avoid sort of high fat foods as well. But they have also diagnosed calcium deficiency if these animals are fed invertebrates only and not a sort of more general mixed diet, and no supplements. So worth bearing that in mind, particularly in younger animals as they're growing. I've also got a few slides just on anaesthesia because I've mentioned a lot of the diagnostic tests that we're doing require anaesthetics to get those samples, but also perhaps to perform a full clinical examination. This is a wee box that we've got as an induction chamber. We have actually got the ability, I don't know if you can see from that picture, but you can divide it in half. So there's a smaller space for your air to fill. And I would also always cover these over while the animal's being induced so that they hopefully are less stressed. It is worth fasting your little hedgehogs because I mentioned earlier that they can't easily vomit. So if you've got a very full stomach, that could put pressure on the diaphragm under anaesthesia. So I would probably not feed them there. You know, if, most often you're doing this during the day and they've eaten overnight, so there naturally is a fasting period, but perhaps don't give them any food first thing that morning. We do need to be thinking about our fluid therapy and our thermal support. You can see a little hot pad that's just to the right of the picture there, the pink structure. And we might want to consider some analgesia and some atropine as a pre-med to prevent sort of build up of secretions while the animal's anaesthetized. Just showing you that animal now has been placed on a face mask and on a little heat disc, and we're very quickly going to examine this animal. If we need to take diagnostic samples, we'll do that at the same time and have everything prepared and ready to go, wearing gloves as well, obviously, in this picture. It is possible to intubate these guys, and actually fairly straightforward. They have quite a fleshy tongue, but if you pull the tongue forwards, you can see the glottis at the base of the tongue. And we can also place IV catheters. I mentioned the cephalic vein. That's the site we would probably use. They usually do have to be taken out on recovery because the hedgehog starts to curl up and you can't easily get hold of the forelimb. But if you've got a more prolonged anaesthetic and you want to be giving IV fluids, you could also do intraosseous as well, actually, that'd be fairly straightforward. But again, I probably would remove that as the animal's recovering because it's going to be difficult then to remove it once it's fully conscious and trying to curl up. If we're actually getting an area ready for surgery and wanting to prepare that area, then we do want to minimize the amount of spines that we're removing because these are going to take quite a while to grow back. So just something to be aware of. So this is just showing you an animal that's been intubated. We have to be very careful with these tiny little silicone tubes because they can easily kink and you can get mucus plugs. And obviously that would prevent the animal from breathing. So really, really close attention to your tube is absolutely key. And then we've got little Doppler attached as well and a CO2 monitor too. And then finally thinking about what sort of problems we could potentially get from these animals. I think owners are often not really aware of this, and particularly we'd mentioned about salmonella and that it can be a subclinical infection. So good hygiene around the pets, always washing your hands afterwards, not allowing them in food preparation areas is really, really important. I'd also mention ringworm, and this can be contractable by owners. But interestingly, also human herpes simplex virus or cold sores can actually be infectious towards hedgehogs. So we really don't recommend generally owners kissing their pets, but this is a particular area. If someone's got a cold sore, we don't want to pass that on to their pet. And then I mentioned also sort of I hadn't mentioned, but endoparasites such as Cryptosporidium and fungal infections, other fungal infections as well. So I hope you've enjoyed the webinar and that you found it useful and has given you some ideas of things that you might be able to do in practice. There was just one extra thing I wanted to mention at the end. Had a question about the antifungals that I would use for ringworm. I didn't actually mention any particular types, but one that I have used is oral itraconazole. The dose rate for this is 5 to 10 mg per kg per os, 12 to 24 hourly. I think if I was going for a difficult animal to medicate, I'd go with a higher dose, 10 mg per kg once a day. And we would usually do this for at least 4 weeks. One thing that we've been doing actually with other species is pulse therapy, weekend pulse therapy for antifungal treatment. And I think this would be something in the future that would be really interesting to trial in the African pygmy hedgehog as well. And I would be thinking of doing 4 weeks of daily medication and then weekend pulse therapy for another 4 weeks. And obviously you want to reculture to check that you are clear. And it's something that perhaps you also want to be considering rechecking 3 to 6 months down the line, you know, perhaps do repeat coat brushings to check because of the risk, you know, to the owner as well. You could also potentially use terbinafine at 100 mg per kg per os twice daily. And I have also used topical N-ilconazole once daily, and the dilution and the dose is very similar. You're just extrapolating from dog dose there. So I hope that has been helpful for you. Thank you very much for listening, and please go out and enjoy treating these amazing animals. Bye for now.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Emma for a great presentation today. The recording and certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.